Harding says.
Who the hell says so? Jesus, I haven't missed a World Series in years. Even when I was in the cooler one September, they let us bring in a TV and watch the series. They'd have had a riot on their hands if they hadn't. I just may have to kick that damn door down and walk to some bar downtown to see the game. Just me and my buddy Cheswick.
Now there's a suggestion with a lot of merit, Harding says, tossing down his magazine.
Why not bring that up for vote in group meeting tomorrow? Miss Ratchet, I'd like to move that the ward be transported en masse to the idle hour for beer and television.
I'd second the motion, Cheswick says. Damn right.
The hell with that en masse business, McMurphy says. I'm tired of looking at you bunch of old ladies. When me and Cheswick bust out of here, I think, by God, I'm gonna nail that door shut behind me. You guys better stay behind. Your mama probably wouldn't let you cross the street.
Yeah? Is that it?
Fredrickson has come up behind McMurphy.
You're just gonna raise one of those big He-Man boots of yours and kick down the door?
Real tough guy.
McMurphy don't look at Fredrickson. He's learned that Fredrickson might act hard-boiled now and then, but it's an act that folds under the slightest scare.
What about it, He-Man?
Fredrickson keeps on.
Are you gonna kick down that door and show us how tough you are?
No, Fred, I guess not. I wouldn't want to scuff up my boot.
Yeah? Okay, you've been talking so big. Just how would you go about busting out of here?
McMurphy takes a look around him.
Well, guess I could knock the mesh out of one of these windows with a chair when and if I took a notion.
Yeah, you could you? Knock it right out? Okay, let's see you try. Come on, hey man, I'll bet you $10 you can't do it.
Don't bother trying, Mac, Cheswick says. Fredrickson knows you'll just break a chair and end up on Disturbed. The first day we arrived over here, we were given a demonstration about these screens. They're specially made. A technician picked up a chair just like that one you've got your feet on. And he beat the screen till the chair was no more than kindling wood. Didn't hardly dent the screen.
Okay, then, McMurphy says, taking a look around him. I can see he's getting more interested. I hope the big nurse isn't hearing this. He'll be up on Disturbed in an hour.
We need something heavier. How about a table? Same as the chair, same wood, same weight.
All right, by God, let's just figure out what I'd have to toss through that screen to bust out. And if you birds don't think I'd do it if I ever got the urge, then you got another thing coming.
Okay, something bigger than a table or a chair.
Well, if it was night, I might throw that fat coon through it. He's heavy enough.
Much too soft, Harding says. He'd hit the screen and it would dice him like an eggplant.
How about one of the beds?
A bed is too big, even if you could lift it. It wouldn't go through the window.
I could lift it all right.
Well, hell, right over there you are. That thing Billy's sitting on. That big control panel with all the handles and cranks. That's hard enough, ain't it? And it damn well should be heavy enough.
Sure, Fredrickson says. That's the same as you kicking your foot through the steel door at the front.
What will be wrong with using the panel? Don't look nailed down.
No, it's not bolted. There's probably nothing holding it but a few wires, but look at it, for Christ's sakes.
Everybody looks. The panel is steel and cement, half the size of one of the tables, probably weighs 400 pounds.
Okay, I'm looking at it. It don't look any bigger than the hay bales I've bucked up on the truck beds.
I'm afraid, my friend, that this contrivance will weigh a bit more than your bales of hay.
About a quarter ton more, I'd bet, Fredrickson says.
He's right, Mac,
Cheswick says.
It'd be awful heavy. Hell, are you birds telling me I can't lift that dinky little gizmo?
My friend, I don't recall anything about psychopaths being able to move mountains in addition to their other noteworthy assets.
Okay, you say I can't lift it? Well, by God.
McMurphy hops off the table and goes to peeling off his green jacket. The tattoos sticking half out of his t-shirt jump around the muscles on his arms.
Then who's willing to lay $5? Nobody's going to convince me I can't do something till I try it. $5?
McMurphy, this is as foolhardy as your bet about the nurse.
Who's got $5 they want to lose? You hit or you sit?
The guys all go to signing liens at once. He's beat them so many times at poker and blackjack, they can't wait to get back at him, and this is a certain sure thing. I don't know what he's driving at. Broad and big as he is, it'd take three of him to move that panel, and he knows it. He can just look at it and see he probably couldn't even tip it, let alone lift it. It'd take a giant to lift it off the ground. But when the acutes all get their IOU signed, he steps up to the panel and lifts Billy Bibbit down off it and spits in his big calloused palms and slaps them together, rolls his shoulders.
Okay, stand out of the way. Sometimes when I go to exerting myself, I use up all the air nearby and grown men faint from suffocation. Stand back. There's liable to be cracking cement and flying steel. Get the women and kids someplace safe. Stand back.
By golly, he might do it, Cheswick mutters.
Sure, maybe he'll talk it off the floor,
Fredrickson says. More likely he'll acquire a beautiful hernia, Harding says.
Come now, McMurphy, quit acting like a fool. There's no man can lift that thing.
Stand back, sissies, you're using my oxygen.
McMurphy shifts his feet a few times to get a good stance and wipes his hands on his thighs again, then leans down and gets hold of the levers on each side of the panel. When he goes to straining, the guys go to hooting and kidding him. He turns loose and straightens up and shifts his feet around again.
Giving up?
Fredrickson grins.
Just limbering up.
Here goes the real effort. And grabs those levers again. And suddenly nobody's hooting at him anymore. His arms commence to swell and the veins squeeze up to the surface. He clenches his eyes and his lips draw away from his teeth. His head leans back and tendons stand out like coiled ropes running from his heaving neck down both arms to his hands. His whole body shakes with the strain as he tries to lift something he knows he can't lift, something everybody knows he can't lift. But just for a second, when we hear the cement grind at our feet, we think, by golly, he might do it. Then his breath explodes out of him and he falls back limp against the wall. There's blood on the levers where he tore his hands. He pants for a minute against the wall with his eyes shut. There's no sound but his scraping breath. Nobody's saying a thing. He opens his eyes and looks around at us. One by one, he looks at the guys, even at me. Then he fishes in his pockets for all the IOUs he won the last few days at poker. He bends over the table and tries to sort them, but his hands are frozen to red claws and he can't work the fingers. Finally, he throws the whole bundle on the floor, probably $40 or $50 worth from each man, and turns to walk out of the tub room. He stops at the door and looks back at everybody standing around.
But I tried, though, he says. God damn it, I sure as hell did that much. Now didn't I?
And walks out and leaves those stained pieces of paper on the floor for whoever wants to sort through them. A visiting doctor, covered with gray cobwebs on his yellow skull, is addressing the resident boys in the staff room. I come sweeping past him.
Oh, and what's this here?
He gives me a look like I'm some kind of bug. One of the residents points at his ears, signal that I'm deaf, and the visiting doctor goes on. I push my broom up face to face with a great big picture public relation brought in one time when it was fogged so thick I didn't see him. The picture is a guy fly fishing somewhere in the mountains. Looks like the Ochocos near Painville. Snow on the peaks showing over the pines. Long white aspen trunks lining the stream. Sheep sorrel growing in sour green patches. The guy is flicking his fly in a pool behind a rock. It's no place for a fly. It's a place for a single leg on a number six hook. He'd do better to drift the fly over those riffles downstream. There's a path running down through the aspen, and I push my broom down the path a ways and sit down on a rock and look back out through the frame at that visiting doctor talking with the residents. I can see him stabbing some point in the palm of his hand with his finger, but I can't hear what he says because of the crash of the cold, frothy stream coming down out of the rocks. I can smell the snow and the wind where it blows down off the peaks. I can see mole burrows humping along under the grass and buffalo weed. It's a real nice place to stretch your legs and take it easy. You forget, if you don't sit down and make the effort to think back, forget how it was at the old hospital. They didn't have nice places like this on the walls for you to climb into. They didn't have TV or swimming pools or chicken twice a month. They didn't have nothing but walls and chairs, confinement jackets it took you hours of hard work to get out of. They've learned a lot since then.
Come a long way, says Fat Face Public Relation. They've made life look very pleasant with paint and decorations and chrome bathroom fixtures. A man that would want to run away from a place as nice as this,
says Fat-Faced Public Relation. Why, there'd be something wrong with him. Out in the staff room, the visiting authority is hugging his elbows and shivering like he's cold while he answers questions the resident boys ask him. He's thin and meatless, and his clothes flap around his bones. He stands there hugging his elbows and shivering. Maybe he feels the cold snow wind off the peaks, too. It's getting hard to locate my bed at night. Have to crawl around on my hands and knees feeling underneath the springs till I find my gobs of gum stuck there. Nobody complains about all the fog. I know why now. As bad as it is, you can slip back in it and feel safe. That's what McMurphy can't understand. Us wanting to be safe. He keeps trying to drag us out of the fog, out in the open where we'd be easy to get at. There's a shipment of frozen parts come in downstairs. Hearts and kidneys and brains and the like. I can hear them rumble into cold storage down the coal chute. A guy sitting in the room someplace I can't see is talking about a guy up on Disturbed killing himself. Old Roller. Cut both nuts off and bled to death. Sitting right on the can in the latrine. Half a dozen people in there with him didn't know it till he fell off to the floor. Dead. What makes people so impatient is what I can't figure. All the guy had to do was wait. I know how they work it, the fog machine. We had a whole platoon used to operate fog machines around airfields overseas. Whenever intelligence figured there might be a bombing attack, or if the generals had something secret they wanted to pull, out of sight, hid so good that even the spies on the base couldn't see what went on, they fogged the field. It's a simple rig. You got an ordinary compressor sucks water out of one tank and a special oil out of another tank and compresses them together, and from the black stem at the end of the machine blooms a white cloud of fog that can cover a whole airfield in 90 seconds. The first thing I saw when I landed in Europe was the fog those machines make. There were some interceptors close after our transport, and soon as it hit the ground, the fog crew started up the machines. We could look out the transport's round, scratched windows and watch the jeeps draw the machines up close to the plane and watch the fog boil out till it rolled across the field and stuck against the windows like wet cotton. You found your way off the plane by following a little referee's horn the lieutenant kept blowing. Sounded like a goose honking. Soon as you were out of the hatch, you couldn't see no more than maybe 3 feet in any direction. You felt like you were out on that airfield all by yourself. You were safe from the enemy, but you were awfully alone. Sounds died and dissolved after a few yards, and you couldn't hear any of the rest of your crew. Nothing but that little horn squeaking and honking out of a soft, furry whiteness, so thick that your body just faded into white below the belt. Other than that brown shirt and brass buckle, you couldn't see nothing but white, like from the waist down you were being dissolved by that fog, too. And then some guy wandering as lost as you would all of a sudden be right before your eyes, his face bigger and clearer than you ever saw a man's face before in your life. Your eyes were working so hard to see in that fog that when something did come in sight, every detail was 10 times as clear as usual. So clear both of you had to look away. When a man showed up, you didn't want to look at his face, and he didn't want to look at yours, because it's painful to see somebody so clear that it's like looking inside him, but then neither did you want to look away and lose him completely. You had a choice. You could either strain and look at things that appeared in front of you in the fog, painful as it might be, or you could relax and lose yourself. When they first used that fog machine on the ward, one they bought from Army Surplus and hid in the vents in the new place before we moved in. I kept looking at anything that appeared out of the fog as long and as hard as I could to keep track of it, just like I used to do when they fogged the airfields in Europe. Nobody'd be blowing a horn to show the way. There was no rope to hold on to, so fixing my eyes on something was the only way I kept from getting lost. Sometimes I got lost in it anyway, got in too deep, trying to hide, and every time I did, it seemed like I always turned up at that same place, at that same metal door with a row of rivets like eyes and no number, just like the room behind that door drew me to it, no matter how hard I tried to stay away, just like the current generated by the fiends in that room was conducted in a long beam along the fog and pulled me back into it like a robot. I'd wander for days in the fog, scared I'd never see another thing. Then there'd be that door, opening to show me the mattress padding on the other side to stop out the sounds. The men standing in line like zombies among shiny copper wires and tubes pulsing light and the bright scrape of arcing electricity. I'd take my place in the line and wait my turn at the table. The table shaped like a cross, with shadows of 1,000 murdered men printed on it, silhouette wrists and ankles running under leather straps sweated green with use, a silhouette neck and head running up to a silver band goes across the forehead, and a technician at the controls, beside the table, looking up from his dials and down the line and pointing at me with a rubber glove. "Wait, I know that big bastard there. Better rabbit punch him or call for some help or something. He's an awful case for thrashing around." So I used to try not to get in too deep, for fear I'd get lost and turn up at the shock shop door. I looked hard at anything that came into sight, and hung on like a man in a blizzard hangs on a fence rail. But they kept making the fog thicker and thicker, and it seemed to me that, no matter how hard I tried, 2 or 3 times a month I found myself with that door opening in front of me to the acid smell of sparks and ozone. In spite of all I could do, it was getting tough to keep from getting lost. Then I discovered something. I don't have to end up at that door if I stay still when the fog comes over me and just keep quiet. The trouble was I'd been finding that door my own self because I got scared of being lost so long and went to hollering so they could track me. In a way, I was hollering for them to track me. I had figured that anything was better than being lost for good, even the shock shop. Now I don't know. Being lost isn't so bad. All this morning I've been waiting for them to fog us in again. The last few days they've been doing it more and more. It's my idea they're doing it on account of McMurphy. They haven't got him fixed with controls yet, and they're trying to catch him off guard. They can see he's due to be a problem. A 6 times already he's roused Cheswick and Harding and some of the others to where it looked like they might actually stand up to one of the black boys. But always, just the time it looked like the patient might be helped, the fog would start. Like it's starting now. I heard the compressor start pumping in the grill a few minutes back, just as the guys went to moving tables out of the day room for the therapeutic meeting, and already the mist is oozing across the floor, so thick my pant legs are wet. I'm cleaning the windows in the door of the glass station, and I hear the big nurse pick up the phone and call the doctor to tell him we're just about ready for the meeting, and tell him perhaps he'd best keep an hour free this afternoon for a staff meeting. "The reason being," she tells him, "I think it's past time to have a discussion of the subject of patient Randall McMurphy, and whether he should be on this ward or not." She listens a minute, then tells him, "I don't think it's wise to let him go on upsetting the patients the way he has the last few days. That's why she's fogging the ward for the meeting. She don't usually do that. But now she's going to do something with McMurphy today. Probably ship him to disturbed." I put down my window rag and go to my chair at the end of the line of chronics, barely able to see the guys getting into their chairs and the doctor coming through the door, wiping his glasses like he thinks the blurred look comes from his steamed lenses instead of the fog. It's rolling in thicker than I ever seen it before. I can hear them out there trying to go on with the meeting, talking some nonsense about Billy Bibbit's stutter and how it came about. The words come to me like through water, it's so thick. In fact, it's so much like water it floats me right up out of my chair, and I don't know which end is up for a while. Floating makes me a little sick to the stomach at first. I can't see a thing. I never had it so thick it floated me like this. The words get dim and loud off and on as I float around, but as loud as they get, loud enough sometimes I know I'm right next to the guy that's talking, I still can't see a thing. I recognize Billy's voice, stuttering worse than ever because he's nervous.
"Flunked out of college because I quit ROTC. I couldn't take it. Whenever the officer in charge of class would call roll, call Bibbit, I couldn't answer. You were supposed to say,
He's choking on the word like it's a bone in his throat. I hear him swallow and start again.
You were supposed to say, "Here, sir," and I never could get it out.
His voice gets dim. Then the big nurse's voice comes cutting from the left.
Can you recall, Billy, when you first had speech trouble? When did you first stutter? Do you remember?
I can't tell. Is he laughing or what?
First stutter? First stutter?
The first word I said, I stuttered.
Mama.
Then the talking fades out altogether. I never knew that to happen before. Maybe Billy's hid himself in the fog, too. Maybe all the guys finally and forever crowded back into the fog. A chair and me float past each other. It's the first thing I've seen. It comes sifting out of the fog off to my right, and for a few seconds it's right beside my face, just out of my reach. I've been accustomed of late to just let things alone when they appear in the fog, sit still and not try to hang on. But this time I'm scared, the way I used to be scared. I try with all I got to pull myself over to the chair and get hold of it, but there's nothing to brace against, and all I can do is thrash in the air. All I can do is watch the chair come clear, clearer than ever before, to where I can even make out the fingerprint where a worker touched the varnish before it was dry, looming out for a few seconds, then fading on off again. I'd never seen it where things floated around this way. I'd never seen it this thick before. Thick to where I can't get down to the floor and get on my feet if I wanted to and walk around. That's why I'm so scared. I feel I'm going to float off someplace for good this time. I see a chronic float into sight a little below me. It's old Colonel Matterson, reading from the wrinkled scripture of that long yellow hand. I look close at him because I figure it's the last time I'll ever see him. His face is enormous, almost more than I can bear. Every hair and wrinkle of him is big, as though I was looking at him with one of those microscopes. I see him so clear I see his whole life. The face is 60 years of Southwest Army camps, rutted by iron-rimmed caisson wheels, worn to the bone by thousands of feet on 2-day marches. He holds out that long hand and brings it up in front of his eyes and squints into it, brings up his other hand, and underlines the words with a finger, wooden and varnished, the color of a gunstock by nicotine. His voice is deep and slow and patient, and I see the words come out dark and heavy over his brittle lips when he reads.
"Now, the flag is America. America is the plum, the peach, the watermelon. America is the gumdrop, the pumpkin seed. America is television."
It's true. It's all wrote down on that yellow hand. I can read it along with him myself.
"Now, the cross is Mexico."
He looks up to see if I'm paying attention, and when he sees I am, he smiles at me and goes on.
"Mexico is the walnut, the hazelnut, the acorn. Mexico is the rainbow. The rainbow is wooden. Mexico is wooden."
I can see what he's driving at. He's been saying this sort of thing for the whole 6 years he's been here, but I never paid him any mind. Figured he was no more than a talking statue. A thing made out of bone and arthritis, rambling on and on with these goofy definitions of his that didn't make a lick of sense. Now, at last, I see what he's saying. I'm trying to hold him for one last look to remember him, and that's what makes me look hard enough to understand.
He pauses and peers up at me again to make sure I'm getting it, and I want to yell out to him, "Yes, I see. Mexico is the walnut. It's brown and hard, and you feel it with your eye, and it feels like the walnut. You're making sense, old man, a sense of your own. You're not crazy the way they think. Yes, I see." But the fog's clogged my throat to where I can't make a sound. As he sifts away, I see him bend back over that hand. "Now, the green sheep is Canada. Canada is the fir tree, the wheat field, the calendar." I strain to see him drifting away. I strain so hard my eyes ache, and I have to close them, and when I open them again, the colonel is gone. I'm floating by myself again, more lost than ever. "This is the time," I tell myself. "I'm going for good. There's old Pete, face like a searchlight. He's 50 yards off to my left, but I can see him plain as though there wasn't any fog at all. Or maybe he's right up close and real small. I can't be sure. He tells me once about how tired he is, and just his saying it makes me see his whole life on the railroad, see him working to figure out how to read a watch, breaking a sweat while he tries to get the right button in the right hole of his railroad overalls, doing his absolute damnedest to keep up with a job that comes so easy to the others they can sit back in a chair padded with cardboard and read mystery stories and girly books. Not that he ever really figured to keep up. He knew from the start he couldn't do that. But he had to try to keep up, just to keep them in sight. So for 40 years he was able to live, if not right in the world of men, at least on the edge of it. I can see all that, and be hurt by it, the way I was hurt by seeing things in the army, in the war, the way I was hurt by seeing what happened to Papa and the tribe. I thought I'd got over seeing those things and fretting over them. There's no sense in it. There's nothing to be done.
"I'm tired," is what he says.
"I know you're tired, Pete, but I can't do you no good fretting about it. You know I can't." Pete floats on the way of the old colonel. Here comes Billy Bibbit, the way Pete come by. They're all filing by for a last look. I know Billy can't be more than a few feet away, but he's so tiny he looks like he's a mile off. His face is out to me like the face of a beggar, needing so much more than anybody can give. His mouth works like a little doll's mouth.
"And even when I proposed, I flubbed it. I said, 'Honey, will you till the girl broke out laughing.
Nurse's voice. Can't see where it comes from. "Your mother has spoken to me about this girl, Billy. Apparently she was quite a bit beneath you. What would you speculate it was about her that frightened you so, Billy?"
"I was in love with her."
"I can't do nothing for you either, Billy. You know that. None of us can. You got to understand that as soon as a man goes to help somebody, he leaves himself wide open. He has to be cagey, Billy. You should know that as well as anyone. What could I do? I can't fix your stuttering. I can't wipe the razor blade scars off your wrists or the cigarette burns off the back of your hands. Can't give you a new mother. And as far as the nurse riding you like this, rubbing your nose in your weakness till what little dignity you got left is gone and you shrink up to nothing from humiliation, I can't do anything about that either. At Anzio, I saw a buddy of mine tied to a tree 50 yards from me, screaming for water, his face blistered in the sun. They wanted me to try to go out and help him. They'd have cut me in half from that farmhouse over there. Put your face away, Billy." They keep filing past. It's like each face was a sign like one of those "I'm blind" signs the Dago accordion players in Portland hung around their necks, only these signs say, "I'm tired," or "I'm scared,"
or I'm dying of a bum liver, or I'm all bound up with machinery and people pushing me all the time. I can read all the signs. It don't make any difference how little the print gets. Some of the faces are looking around at one another and could read the other fellows if they would, but what's the sense? The faces blow past in the fog like confetti. I'm further off than I've ever been. This is what it's like to be dead. I guess this is what it's like to be a vegetable. You lose yourself in the fog. You don't move. They feed your body till it stops eating, then they burn it. It's not so bad. There's no pain. I don't feel much of anything other than a touch of chill. I figure we'll pass in time. I see my commanding officer pinning notices on the bulletin board, what we're to wear today. I see the U.S. Department of Interior bearing down on our little tribe with a gravel-crushing machine. I see Papa come loping out of a draw and slow up to try to take aim at a big 6-point buck springing off through the cedars. Shot after shot puffs out of the barrel, knocking dust all around the buck. I come out of the draw behind Papa and bring the buck down with my second shot just as it starts climbing the rim rock. I grin at Papa. I never knew you to miss a shot like that before, Papa. Eyes gone, boy. Can't hold a bead. Sights on my gun just now was shaking like a dog shitting peach pits. Papa, I'm telling you, that cactus moon of SIDS is gonna make you old before your time. A man drinks that cactus moon of SIDS, boy, he's already old before his time. Let's go get that animal out before the flies blow him. That's not even happening now. You see? There's nothing you can do about a happening out of the past like that.
Look there, my man.
I hear whispers. Black boys.
Look there, that old fool Broom slipped off to sleep.
That's right, Chief Broom, that's right. You sleep and keep out of trouble, yes.
I'm not cold anymore. I think I've about made it. I'm off to where the cold can't reach me. I can stay off here for good. I'm not scared anymore. They can't reach me. Just the words reach me, and those are fading.
Well, inasmuch as Billy has decided to walk out on the discussion, does anyone else have a problem to bring before the group? As a matter of fact, ma'am, there does happen to be something.
That's that McMurphy. He's far away. He's still trying to pull people out of the fog. Why don't he leave me be?
Remember that vote we had a day or so back about the TV time? Well, today's Friday, and I thought I might just bring it up again just to see if anybody else has picked up a little guts.
Mr. McMurphy, the purpose of this meeting is therapy. Group therapy. And I'm not certain these petty grievances...
Yeah, the hell with that. We've heard it before. Me and some of the rest of the guys decided...
One moment, Mr. McMurphy. Let me pose a question to the group. Do any of you feel that Mr. McMurphy is perhaps imposing his personal desires on some of you too much? I've been thinking you might be happier if he were moved to a different ward.
Nobody says anything for a minute. Then someone says,
Let him vote, why don't you? Why you want to ship him to Disturb just for bringing up a vote? What's so wrong with changing time?
Why, Mr. Scanlon, as I recall, you refused to eat for 3 days until we allowed you to turn the set on at 6 instead of 6:30.
A man needs to see the world news, don't he? God, they could have bombed Washington, and it had been a week before we'd heard.
Yes? And how do you feel about relinquishing your world news to watch a bunch of men play baseball?
Can't have both, huh? No, I suppose not. Well, what the dickens? I don't guess they'll bomb us this week. Let's let him have the vote, Miss Ratchet.
Very well. But I think this is ample evidence of how much he is upsetting some of you patients. What is it you are proposing, Mr. McMurphy?
I'm proposing a re-vote on watching the TV in the afternoon.
You're certain one more vote will satisfy you? We have more important things.
It'll satisfy me. I just kind of like to see which of these birds has any guts and which doesn't.
It's that kind of talk, Dr. Spivey, that makes me wonder if the patients wouldn't be more content if Mr. McMurphy were moved.
Let him call a vote, why don't you?
Certainly, Mr. Cheswick. A vote is now before the group. Will a show of hands be adequate, Mr. McMurphy, or are you going to insist on a secret ballot?
I want to see the hands. I want to see the hands that don't go up, too.
everyone in favor of changing the television time to the afternoon raise his hand.
The first hand that comes up I can tell is McMurphy's, because of the bandage where that control panel cut into him when he tried to lift it. And then off down the slope I see them, other hands coming up out of the fog. It's like that big red hand of McMurphy's is reaching into the fog and dropping down and dragging the men up by their hands, dragging them blinking into the open. First one, then another, then the next, right on down the line of acutes, dragging them out of the fog till there they stand, all 20 of them, raising not just for watching TV, but against the big nurse, against her trying to send McMurphy to Disturbed, against the way she's talked and acted and beat them down for years. Nobody says anything. I can feel how stunned everybody is, the patients as well as the staff. The nurse can't figure out what happened. Yesterday, before he tried lifting that panel, there wasn't but 4 or 5 men might have voted. But when she talks, she don't let it show in her voice how surprised she is.
I count only 20, Mr. McMurphy.
20? Well, why not? 20 is all of us there. His voice hangs as he realizes what she means.
Now hold on just a goddamn minute, lady.
I'm afraid the vote is defeated.
Hold on just one goddamn minute.
There are 40 patients on the ward, Mr. McMurphy. 40 patients, and only 20 voted. You must have a majority to change ward policy. I'm afraid the vote is closed.
The hands are coming down across the room. The guys know they're whipped and are trying to slip back into the safety of the fog. McMurphy is on his feet.
Well, I'll be a son of a bitch. You mean to tell me that's how you're going to pull it? Count the votes of those old birds over there, too?
Didn't you explain the voting procedure to him, Doctor?
I'm afraid a majority is called for, McMurphy. She's right. She's right.
A majority, Mr. McMurphy. It's in the ward constitution.
And I suppose the way to change the damn constitution is with a majority vote, sure. Of all the chicken shit things I've ever seen, this by God takes the cake.
I'm sorry, Mr. McMurphy, but you'll find it written in the policy if you'd care for me to...
So this is how you work this democratic bullshit. Hell's bells.
You seem upset, Mr. McMurphy. Doesn't he seem upset, Doctor? I want you to note this.
Don't give me that noise, lady. When a guy's getting screwed, he's got a right to holler, and we've been damn well screwed.
Perhaps, Doctor, in view of the patient's condition, we should bring this meeting to a close early today.
Wait. Wait a minute. Let me talk to some of those old guys.
The vote is closed, Mr. McMurphy.
Let me talk to him.
He's coming across the day room at us. He gets bigger and bigger, and he's burning red in the face. He reaches into the fog and tries to drag Ruckley to the surface because Ruckley's the youngest.
What about you, buddy? You want to watch the World Series? Baseball? Baseball games? Just raise that hand up there. Fuck the wife!
All right, forget it. You, partner, how about you? What was your name? Ellis? What do you say, Ellis, to watching a ball game on TV? Just raise your hand. Ellis's hands are nailed to the wall. Can't be counted as a vote.
I said the voting is closed, Mr. McMurphy. You're just making a spectacle of yourself.
He don't pay any attention to her. He comes on down the line of chronics.
Come on, come on, just one vote from you birds. Just raise a hand, show her you can still do it.
I'm tired,
says Pete and wags his head.
The night is the Pacific Ocean.
The colonel is reading off his hand, can't be bothered with voting.
One of you guys, for crying out loud, this is where you get the edge, don't you see that? We have to do this or we're whipped. Don't one of you clucks know what I'm talking about enough to give us a hand? You, Gabriel. George? No? You, Chief, what about you?
He's standing over me in the mist. Why won't he leave me be?
Chief, you're our last bet.
The big nurse is folding her papers. The other nurses are standing up around her. She finally gets to her feet. The meeting is adjourned then, I hear her say. And I'd like to see the staff down in the staff room in about an hour, so if there's nothing else...
It's too late to stop it now. McMurphy did something to it that first day,
put some kind of hex on it with his hand so it won't act like I order it. There's no sense in it. Any fool can see. I wouldn't do it on my own. Just by the way the nurse is staring at me with her mouth empty of words, I can see I'm in for trouble. But I can't stop it. McMurphy's got hidden wires hooked to it, lifting it slow just to get me out of the fog and into the open where I'm fair game. He's doing it. Wires. No. That's not the truth. I lifted it myself. McMurphy whoops and drags me standing, pounding my back.
21! The chief's vote makes it 21, and by God, if that ain't a majority, I'll eat my hat.
Yippee! Cheswick yells. The other acutes are coming across toward me.
The meeting was closed, she says.
Her smile is still there, but the back of her neck as she walks out of the day room and into the nurse's station is red and swelling like she'll blow apart any second. But she don't blow up. Not right off. Not until about an hour later. Behind the glass, her smile is twisted and queer, like we've never seen before. She just sits. I can see her shoulders rise and fall as she breathes. McMurphy looks up at the clock and he says it's time for the game. He's over by the drinking fountain with some of the other acutes, down on his knees scouring off the baseboard. I'm sweeping out the broom closet for the 10th time that day. Scanlon and Harding, they got the buffer going up and down the hall, polishing the new wax into shining figure eights. McMurphy says again that he guesses it must be game time and he stands up, leaving the scouring rag where it lies. Nobody else stops work. McMurphy walks past the window where she's glaring out at him and grins at her like he knows he's got her whipped now. When he tips his head back and winks at her, she gives that little sideways jerk of her head. Everybody keeps on at what he's doing, but they all watch out of the corners of their eyes while he drags his armchair out to in front of the TV set, then switches on the set and sits down. A picture swirls onto the screen of a parrot out on the baseball field singing Razorblade songs. McMurphy gets up and turns up the sound to drown out the music coming down from the speaker in the ceiling, and he drags another chair in front of him and sits down and crosses his feet on the chair and leans back and lights a cigarette. He scratches his belly and yawns.
Hoo-wee! Man, all I need me now is a can of beer and a red hot.
We can see the nurse's face get red and her mouth work as she stares at him. She looks around for a second and sees everybody's watching what she's going to do. Even the black boys and the little nurses sneaking looks at her and the residents beginning to drift in for the staff meeting. They're watching. Her mouth clamps shut. She looks back at McMurphy and waits till the Razorblade song is finished. Then she gets up and goes to the steel door where the controls are, and she flips a switch, and the TV picture swirls back into gray. Nothing is left on the screen but a little eye of light beating right down on McMurphy sitting there. That eye don't faze him a bit. To tell the truth, he don't even let on he knows the picture is turned off. He puts his cigarette between his teeth and pushes his cap forward in his red hair till he has to lean back to see out from under the brim, and sits that way, with his hands crossed behind his head and his feet stuck out in a chair, a smoking cigarette sticking out from under his hat brim, watching the TV screen. The nurse stands this as long as she can, then she comes to the door of the nurse's station and calls across to him he'd better help the men with the housework. He ignores her.
I said, Mr. McMurphy, that you are supposed to be working during these hours.
Her voice has a tight whine like an electric saw ripping through pine.
Mr. McMurphy, I'm warning you.
Everybody stopped what he was doing. She looks around her, then takes a step out of the nurse's station towards McMurphy. You're committed, you realize. You are under the jurisdiction of me. The staff. She's holding up a fist, all those red-orange fingernails burning into her palm. Under jurisdiction and control. Harding shuts off the buffer and leaves it in the hall and goes pulls him a chair up alongside McMurphy and sits down and lights him a cigarette, too. Mr. Harding, you return to your scheduled duties. I think how her voice sounds like it hit a nail, and this strikes me so funny I almost laugh. Mr. Harding. Then Cheswick goes and gets him a chair. And then Billy Bibbit goes. And then Scanlan. And then Fredrickson and Seafelt. And then we all put down our mops and brooms and scouring rags, and we all go pull us chairs up.
You men! Stop this! Stop!
And we're all sitting there, lined up in front of that blanked-out TV set, watching the gray screen just like we could see the baseball game clear as day, and she's ranting and screaming behind us. If somebody'd have come in and took a look, men watching a blank TV, a 50-year-old woman hollering and squealing at the back of their heads about discipline and order and recriminations, they'd have thought the whole bunch was crazy as loons. Part 2. Just at the edge of my vision, I can see that white enamel face in the nurse's station, teetering over the desk, see it warp and flow as it tries to pull back into shape. The rest of the guys are watching, too, though they're trying to act like they aren't. They're trying to act like they still got their eyes on nothing but that blank TV in front of us, but anyone can see they're all sneaking looks at the big nurse behind her glass there, just the same as I am. For the first time, she's on the other side of the glass, and getting a taste of how it feels to be watched, when you wish more than anything else to be able to pull a green shade between your face and all the eyes that you can't get away from. The residents, the black boys, all the little nurses, they're watching her too, waiting for her to go down the hall where it's time for the meeting she herself called, and waiting to see how she'll act now that it's known she can be made to lose control. She knows they're watching, but she don't move. Not even when they start strolling down to the staff room without her. I notice all the machinery in the wall is quiet, like it's still waiting for her to move. There's no more fog anyplace. All of a sudden I remember I'm supposed to clean the staff room. I always go down and clean the staff room during these meetings they have. Been doing it for years. But now I'm too scared to get out of my chair. The staff always let me clean the room because they didn't think I could hear. But now that they saw me lift my hand when McMurphy told me to, won't they know I can hear? Won't they figure I've been hearing all these years? Listening to secrets meant only for their ears? What'll they do to me in that staff room if they know that? Still, they expect me to be in there. If I'm not, they'll know for sure that I can hear, be way ahead of me, thinking, you see? He isn't in here cleaning, doesn't that prove it? It's obvious what's to be done. I'm just getting the full force of the dangers we let ourselves in for when we let McMurphy lure us out of the fog. There's a black boy leaning against the wall near the door, arms crossed, pink tongue tip darting back and forth over his lips, watching us sitting in front of the TV set. His eyes dart back and forth like his tongue and stop on me, and I see his leather eyelids raise a little. He watches me for a long time, and I know he's wondering about the way I acted in the group meeting. Then he comes off the wall with a lurch, breaking contact, and goes to the broom closet and brings back a bucket of soapy water and a sponge, drags my arms up and hangs the bucket bale over it, like hanging a kettle on a fireplace boom. "Let's go, Chief," he says. "Let's get up and get to your duties." I don't move. The bucket rocks on my arm. I don't make a sign I heard. He's trying to trick me. He asks me again to get up. And when I don't move, he rolls his eyes up to the ceiling and sighs, reaches down and takes my collar and tugs a little, and I stand up. He stuffs the sponge in my pocket and points up the hall where the staff room is, and I go. And while I'm walking up the hall with the bucket, zoom, the big nurse comes past me with all her old calm speed and power and turns into the door. That makes me wonder. Out in the hall all by myself, I notice how clear it is. No fog any place. It's a little cold where the nurse just went past, and the white tubes in the ceiling circulate frozen light like rods of glowing ice, like frosted refrigerator coils rigged up to glow white. The rods stretch down to the staff room door where the nurse just turned in at the end of the hall, a heavy steel door like the door of the shock shop in Building 1, except there are numbers printed on this one, and this one has a little glass peephole up head high to let the staff peek out at who's knocking. As I get closer, I see there's light seeping out this peephole,
green light, bitter as bile. The staff meeting is about to start in there is why there's this green seepage. It'll be all over the walls and windows by the time the meeting is halfway through, for me to sponge off and squeeze in my bucket, use the water later to clear the drains in the latrine. Cleaning the staff room is always bad. The things I've had to clean up in these meetings nobody'd believe. Horrible things. Poisons manufactured right out of skin pores and acids in the air strong enough to melt a man. I've seen it. I've been in some meetings where the table legs strained and contorted, and the chairs knotted, and the walls gritted against one another till you could have wrung sweat out of the room. I've been in meetings where they kept talking about a patient so long that the patient materialized in the flesh, nude on the coffee table in front of them, vulnerable to any fiendish notion they took. They'd have him smeared around in an awful mess before they were finished. That's why they have me at the staff meetings, because they can be such a messy affair and somebody has to clean up. And since the staff room is open only during the meetings, it's got to be somebody they think won't be able to spread the word what's going on. That's me. I've been at it so long, sponging and dusting and mopping this staff room and the old wooden one at the other place, that the staff usually don't even notice me. I move around in my chores, and they see right through me like I wasn't there. The only thing they'd miss if I didn't show up would be the sponge and the water bucket floating around. But this time when I tap at the door, and the big nurse looks through the peephole, she looks dead at me. And she takes longer than ordinary unlocking that door to let me in. Her face has come back into shape, strong as ever, it seems to me. Everybody else goes ahead spooning sugar in their coffee and borrowing cigarettes the way they do before every meeting, but there's a tenseness in the air. I think it's because of me at first. Then I notice that the big nurse hasn't even sat down, hasn't even bothered to get herself a cup of coffee. She lets me slip through the door and stabs me again with both eyes as I go past her, closes that door when I'm in and locks it, and pivots around and glares at me some more. I know she's suspicious. I thought she might be too upset by the way McMurphy defied her to pay any attention to me, but she don't look shook at all. She's clear-headed, and wondering now just how did Mr. Bromden hear that acute McMurphy asking him to raise his hand on that vote. She's wondering how did he know to lay down his mop and go sit with the acutes in front of that TV set. None of the other chronics did that. She's wondering if it isn't time we did some checking on our Mr. Chief Bromden. I put my back to her and dig into the corner with my sponge. I lift the sponge above my head so everybody in the room can see how it's covered with green slime and how hard I'm working. Then I bend over and rub harder than ever. But hard as I work, and hard as I try to act like I'm not aware of her back there, I can still feel her standing at the door and drilling into my skull, till in a minute she's going to break through, till I'm just about to give up and yell and tell them everything if she don't take those eyes off me. Then she realizes that she's being stared at, too, by all the rest of the staff. Just like she's wondering about me, they are wondering about her and what she's planning to do about that redhead back down there in the day room. They're watching to see what she'll say about him, and they don't care anything about some fool Indian on his hands and knees in the corner. They're waiting for her, so she quits looking at me and goes and draws a cup of coffee and sits down. Stirs sugar in it so careful the spoon never touches the side of the cup. It's the doctor who starts things off. "Now, people, if we can get things rolling." He smiles around at the resident sipping coffee. He's trying not to look at the big nurse. She's sitting there so silent it makes him nervous and fidgety. He grabs out his glasses and puts them on for a look at his watch, goes to winding it while he talks. 15 after. It's past time we started. Now, Miss Ratchet, as most of you know, called this get-together. She phoned me before the therapeutic community meeting and said that, in her opinion, McMurphy was due to constitute a disturbance on the ward. Ever so intuitive, considering what went on a few minutes ago, don't you think? He stops winding his watch on account of it's tight enough another twist is going to spray it all over the place. And he sits there smiling at it, drumming the back of his hand with pink little fingers, waiting. Usually at about this point in the meeting, she'll take over, but she doesn't say anything. "After today," the doctor goes on, "no one can say that this is an ordinary man we're dealing with." "No, certainly not. And he is a disturbing factor, that's obvious. So, As I see it, our course in this discussion is to decide what action to take in dealing with him. I believe the nurse called this meeting, correct me if I'm off base here, Miss Ratchet, to talk the situation out and unify the staff's opinion of what should be done about Mr. McMurphy. He gives her a pleading look, but she still doesn't say anything. She's lifted her face toward the ceiling, checking for dirt most likely, and doesn't appear to have heard a thing he's been saying. The doctor turns to the line of residents across the room. All of them got the same leg crossed and coffee cup on the same knee. You fellows, the doctor says, I realize you haven't had adequate time to arrive at a proper diagnosis of the patient, but you have had a chance at observing him in action. What do you think? The question pops their heads up. Cleverly, he's put them on the carpet, too. They all look from him to the big nurse. Some way she has regained all her old power in a few short minutes. Just sitting there, smiling up at the ceiling and not saying anything, she has taken control again and made everyone aware that she's the force in here to be dealt with. If these boys don't play it just right, they're liable to finish their training up in Portland at the Alki Hospital. They begin to fidget around like the doctor.
He is quite a disturbing influence, all right.
The first boy plays it safe. They all sip their coffee and think about that. Then the next one says, and he could constitute an actual danger.
That's true, the doctor says.
The boy thinks he may have found the key and goes on. Quite a danger, in fact, he says, and moves forward in his chair. Keep in mind that this man performed violent acts for the sole purpose of getting away from the work farm and into the comparative luxury of this hospital. Planned violent acts, the first boy says. And the third boy mutters, of course, the very nature of this plan could indicate that he is simply a shrewd con man and not mentally ill at all. He glances around to see how this strikes her and sees she still hasn't moved or given any sign. But the rest of the staff sits there glaring at him like he said some awful vulgar thing. He sees how he's stepped way out of bounds and tries to bring it off as a joke by giggling and adding, you know, like he who marches out of step hears another drum. But it's too late. The first resident turns on him after setting down his cup of coffee and reaching in his pocket for a pipe big as your fist. Frankly, Alvin, he says to the third boy, I'm disappointed in you. Even if one hadn't read his history, all one should need to do is pay attention to his behavior on the ward to realize how absurd the suggestion is. This man is not only very, very sick, but I believe he is definitely a potential assaultive.
I think that is what Miss Ratchet was suspecting when she called this meeting. Don't you recognize the archetype of a psychopath? I've never heard of a clearer case. This man is a Napoleon, a Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun.
Another one joins in. He remembers the nurse's comments about disturbed.
Robert's right, Alvin. Didn't you see the way the man acted out there today? When one of his schemes was thwarted, he was up out of his chair on the verge of violence. You tell us, Dr. Spivey, what do his records say about violence?
There is a marked disregard for discipline and authority, the doctor says.
Right. His history shows, Alvin, that time and again he has acted out his hostilities against authority figures in school, in the service, and in jail. And I think that his performance after the voting furor today is as conclusive an indication as we can have of what to expect in the future.
He stops and frowns into his pipe, puts it back in his mouth, and strikes a match and sucks the flame into the bowl with a loud popping sound. When it's lit, he sneaks a look up through the yellow cloud of smoke at the big nurse. He must take her silence as agreement because he goes on, more enthusiastic and certain than before.
Pause for a minute and imagine, Alvin, he says, his words cottony with smoke.
Imagine what will happen to one of us when we're alone in individual therapy with Mr. McMurphy.
Imagine you are approaching a particularly painful breakthrough and he decides he's just had all he can take of your, how would he put it, your damn fool college kid prying. You tell him he mustn't get hostile and he says to hell with that. And tell him to calm down, in an authoritarian voice, of course. And here he comes, all 210 red-headed psychopathic Irishman pounds of him, right across the interviewing table at you. Are any of us, for that matter, prepared to deal with Mr. McMurphy when these moments arise?
He puts his size 10 pipe back in the corner of his mouth and spreads his hands on his knees and waits. Everybody's thinking about McMurphy's thick red arms and scarred hands and how his neck comes out of his T-shirt like a rusty wedge. The resident named Alvin has turned pale at the thought. Like that yellow pipe smoke his buddy was blowing at him had stained his face.